Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a Lip Media podcast.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we are recording. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and the Aboriginal elders of other communities who may be listening today.
Welcome to the gays.
Such energy!
Leave it in. Welcome to The Gays Are Revolting, a definitive weekly news source for contemporary gays.
We put the G in LGBTQIA+, and we're here to help you be the best G you can be.
Give us a shout out on Instagram at GaysRevoltingPod, or join our Facebook group at The Gays Are Revolting.
And tell your friends about us. Podcasts rely on word of mouth, so tell your friends how revolting those gays are.
Yeah.
I'm so
pretty revolting.
Welcome back, everybody. We are joined again by our regular host this week. Luke. We have Luke, who, like a speed hump, everybody's had a go, but no one really likes them.
Accurate. Hi, yeah. Murky.
And we also have Kyle. You're like a new chair. Looks like a fun place to sit, but not really good for anything else.
Oh!
And the lovely Thomas, who, like Drag Race, is on a slow decline.
Oh!
How dare you compare me to Drag Race? Oh,
that's like the ultimate insult.
It's like a double rape.
Yeah.
Oh, I love you.
We have such an exciting episode because we have two guests coming on the podcast
tonight. But two.
Stand before me. Oh my God. I would love to watch these two people battle it out because it's the grandma of Melbourne Drag, Miss Candy.
Yes.
And of course, the wonderful Nick Hollis, the founder of the Institute of Many, coming on to talk about some wonderful things. But before we do, I have to tell you, I have to tell Luke and Mikey some very exciting news. So yes. Kyle, it was your partner's Duncan's birthday weeks ago.
Dunk's had his 30th.
Did you have sex with Kyle's brother?
No.
What? Jesus Christ. Now's not the time.
No, I mean, we did make out a little bit, but that's okay. So I bought a present for Duncan.
Yeah.
And you guys are going to love it because I've been trying to get Kyle to watch all these gay films for so long. So I went to JB Hi-Fi and I just bought like six gay films and put them in a thing and said to Duncan, you need to watch these with Kyle.
So it's a present from me. For
basically. So Kyle has now watched Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
It's happening. Oh my God. I'm a new person.
Did you like it?
It was so good.
Do you see why it's so important?
I was smiling a lot. Very, very Australian. I loved all the campy gayness of it. Like, their outfits were insane. The guys, I was laughing so much at the guys, kind of, it's like mail order bride. Like,
The Vietnamese
lady, she was so great. I loved her and her ping pong show.
Oh my
God. I'm so surprised that all the actors aren't actually gay. I think they did a crazy good job.
Yeah. Amazing, yeah.
I saw Briefs, the show, on Thursday. That was fucking phenomenal.
Look at you watching Priscilla.
Yeah, look at me.
And going
gay
to
as hell.
Theater.
I'm glad you've seen Priscilla. It's funny that you talk about the mail order bride because that's like the one problematic thing I have with that film.
Do you know, a few years ago I started thinking that and then I watched an interview with her and it's the proudest thing that she's ever done.
Oh, really?
And I'm kind of like, well, she's
actually doing it. That's probably the one part. It's funny that it is so iconic and like sticks in so many people's minds.
Mm.
But it's also probably the one part of the film that really makes me feel a bit funny. So.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for bringing that up.
And that was
so
that
welcome. Thanks to Tom for giving the DVD.
And that was your mum's only ever acting role, wasn't it?
Yeah, we've lived off that for a very long time.
Can I just say the sound effect they use when the ping pong balls shoot out? My God.
I outgay you all. I met Kylie Minogue.
Oh my God.
I didn't talk about this last week because we had Dr. George on and I didn't think it was like the right time to do it. But I went to the Kylie Minogue concert with our podcast friend, Joel Creasy. So we got there. We we go into this row. We're sitting like three rows from Kylie Minogue. And to my left are all these kids. I'm like, why the fuck are there kids here?
Yeah.
And Joel leant over and goes, oh, they're Kylie's nephews. Next to them is Brendan Minogue, Kylie and Danny's brother. And then next to them is Kylie's parents, Ron and Carol.
Oh my God.
And then sitting to the right of Joel was Danny's, like, so Danny's got a kid at school. So the mum's from the school, she'd gotten cards for them.
Cute.
But they also had t-shirts printed that had pictures of Danny that said hashtag Danny. At, like, a Kylie Minogue concert.
That's a bit awkward.
I was like, okay, whatever.
But then at the end, but then at the end of the show, Joel goes, oh, I've got you a surprise. And he pulls out these wristbands and they were to go backstage after the show. So then we got ushered, like the whole row of us got ushered backstage. It was literally only 40 people. And it was like the family, Kylie's singing teacher from high school, this like couple that have lived down the road from her parents her whole life or whatever. It was literally just 40 close family and friends and me and Joel.
Oh my God.
And anyway, so we're there and like Kylie's like doing this circle of the room and she's like, we've been there for a little while. I didn't, because you know, family and friends. I didn't want to interrupt or whatever. And as she's coming towards us, one of the mums, Danny's school mum friends, walks past me and knocks my arm, which I was holding red wine and I spilled it all down my shirt. And I was like, fuck, I can't meet Kylie Minogue with red wine down on the front of my shirt. So I got Joel and his manager's daughter to sort of form a wall around me while I took off. Took off my jacket and cardigan and took off my t-shirt and turned around and put it back on again and got redressed. Jake Shears is standing 2 meters away from me. Yeah. Kylie Minogue's 5 meters away, redressed. And then as I put the shirt back on, they sort of parted ways and Kylie Minogue came over and she was so fucking lovely. Aww. And so, like, she just performed to 10,000 people or something at Sydney Meyer Music Bowl and was just like
fresh out.
It was a religious experience.
That's so
I love Kylie Minogue and I'm really glad. But we're not here to talk about me.
Oh, bragging.
So I'm so excited to be joined by my favourite drag performer. And I think if you've been to a club in Melbourne in the last several decades, you have definitely seen this person perform. It's Miss Candy. How are you, Miss Candy?
Oh, look, I'm absolutely fantastic. And it's so lovely to be in this room with all you gorgeous young men.
Stop. You dirty flirt. Candy and I perform at this same... I host trivia on Thursday nights at DT's and Candy's there doing Big Bold and Bitter on Saturday nights, which is the best drag show in Melbourne. I don't know if I've told you, though, Candy, about the first time we met. You probably don't remember it.
I probably don't remember.
No, I was started working at the Exchange Hotel when I was 18 years old and one day. You remember that everyone used to go down to the market once Exchange closed and had drinks down there. And I remember the first weekend I worked, we went down to the market and we went up to the upstairs bar and we're all sitting there and I thought I was so fucking cool hanging out with Miss Candy and Lucy Loosebox and Swish Ever Ready. You were so kind to me and I've loved you ever since.
Oh, well, that's good. Look, I'm so, so glad I had a... I hope I didn't do anything wrong.
You did. I don't know if I'm allowed to tell this story.
I don't think so. Well, you must have been gorgeous.
Oh, fuck you. I do. There is something. I probably shouldn't tell it, but I do remember a couple months later after I'd been working there. Please, if you don't like me telling the story, we can cut it out. But we were up at that bar and you said, I'm getting you a shot. And it was peppermint schnapps shot. And you're in a little cocktail dress. And I was sitting at the bar 18 years old.
A little cocktail dress.
A little cocktail dress. And I was dumb as dog shit, little twink sitting at the bar. And you leant over the bar and out of the bottom of that dress fell two balls that you'd pulled out just beforehand just so I could get them right in my face.
I think you were just imagining things. I didn't do it intentionally. Something might have happened to my G-string.
They were lovely balls and I still remember it.
Well, everybody thinks they are.
Now, to get started, I want to know how you started in drag. These days, the story always is every young drag queen started out either at a Halloween party or after watching RuPaul's Drag Race. How did you start in drag? How old were you? Yeah. And did your family know about it? Did your parents know about it?
My parents didn't really know about it. And I got into it by accident, really. Mm. In the old days, they used to have Queen's Birthday picnics.
Oh, yes, I've seen photos from this.
You'd go up to the country, you'd be either going on a train or buses or, you know, and there'd be 1,000 people there. Mm. And, you know, the royal family would arrive, you know, and they had, like, marching teams. And I was a marching team. I was in a marching team and I had a deadpan face and moustache. It was during the 70s.
Right.
The village people were very big, you know. Yeah. So we all had leather on and vinyl, whatever you could afford, check shirts, you know. And then from that, we ended up putting on a show called Misfits at the Ritz, which was, they had about 14 guys in it. I was the youngest. And they were, a lot of them were muscle men.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a whole lot of comedy numbers put together in a show. And we did it over a new show every year. So that's how basically I started. But the drag was...
So we're talking about 40 years ago.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it was really like... it was moustache drag.
Yeah.
You know? So I know moustache drag and beard drag's back.
It's coming
again.
Back now. What's yeah.
That? You know,
what's moustache? Just about facial hair. And,
oh, okay.
Yeah. And then I got jobs in not gay venues. I couldn't get a job in a gay venue, really. I got jobs in straight nightclubs.
Okay.
Because I'd worked in fashion. Owners of the hotel, of the nightclubs, one of them was Inflation, which was in King Street. If you look at Inflation now, it's probably a dump. But at the time, it was huge because it was the first club to have laser lighting and, right. and videos. Ooh. And the whole thing. It was very, fancy. It was full on, you know. It opened with a bang. And at the same time, there was Studio 54, you know, America. It was the same idea.
Yeah, right.
You had to have the crowd out the front. And, you know, the whole poof-toof thing that happened a few weeks ago with people
being exclusive, you know. Yeah.
Well, that was like that. We had gorgeous girls on the outside. Mm. I was gorgeous myself, of course. As a man, this is before I had my sex change put in 76. But they had the pretty girls out the front saying, you can come, and you go. That's just the way it was. So what we witnessed a few weeks ago was happening early. You know, it wasn't something new.
Yeah.
Anyway, cut a long story short, they owners decided to put on a gay night, and it took off. Basically straight away. Wednesday night, it was $8 to get in and you got free wine. That's, you're getting the picture.
That's
here.
That's free, what I want. Gosh, imagine that.
It was free wine and, you know, so the drink of the time was white wine and orange juice.
Okay.
I of course, went white wine and dry ginger.
Of course.
But through that, we had people like Divine came. She appeared.
Wow.
We had the Village People. But when the Village People came, the a lot of the bands were doing this. Boy George, all that was around, and they were doing New Romantic. That was the, you know, all the guys were wearing lipstick and you know, eyeshadow and all that kind of thing. Well, so the Village People all of a sudden had mascara on and lipstick and blush, and it was a whole different. It wasn't the leather man that I remember.
Yeah,
you know, it was a whole different thing.
It was more of a gender bending kind of.
It
thing.
Was that's what it was. I didn't start doing drugs until, and I've never been a drug taker ever.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't realize until when I was watching Underbelly on TV.
Oh yeah,
because I'd worked at all.
Oh, that all that stuff was going on.
No, the thing is that because I'd worked at the Cadillac Bar and I worked at Zuzu's, and outside of all of these places I worked, there were hot dog stands. Right. I used to go and just buy hot dogs. I didn't know you bought your drugs there. I was having hot dog after hot dog.
God, these are good.
But it wasn't until I watched that, and one of the guys who actually ran those hot dogs, he also worked at one of the places in security that I went, and he was one of the guys that was actually shot.
Right.
You know, so it was all kind of...
And all the mafia stuff going on.
I was working there but didn't realise all this was happening around me.
I've been trying to spin this show into a true crime show for many, many months. So I'm happy to take this interview in that direction. Yeah.
And then, so you say your family didn't really know about it then. Did you ever tell your family?
Well, my sister and my brother and that knew. I mean, my... you know, but it was a different time.
Mm.
And I actually really sort of came out pretty late. Mm-hmm. Really. You know, I wasn't very good at coming out. I didn't have a particularly great relationship with my father. He was a shocking drinker.
Right.
Now, perhaps the apple doesn't fall very far from the tree.
But there is a difference between someone that can, like yourself, that works in the scene and that sort of thing.
Well, he was violent.
Yeah, too, right, yeah.
Which, there was never much closeness there. And he was a footballer. And I hate sport.
Yeah.
You know, I've never liked it.
It must be right. Like that.
Do you know what I mean? And I was never very good at it anyway. Mm. So there wasn't a closeness there, basically.
Right.
And then my mother, they separated.
Mm-hmm.
I was close to her. My mother died from emphysema and I was working at the Three Faces at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd been down, my mother was in hospital, and I'd been down to see her. And it was very strange because we were never a real kissy-kissy kind of family, if that makes any sense.
Yeah,
it wasn't.
Not very affectionate.
No. I'm still not, even to with my brother or my other two sisters.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget this day because I basically kissed her and I never sort of kissed her. This is really getting emotional now.
Mm.
And anyway, I get back to where I lived. I was living in Paran and there's a note on the door from the police, and they said she died.
Oh, wow.
It was just, so I don't want to talk about that.
No, yeah, no, but that. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Thank
that
you.
Is,
thank you so much. On a lighter note,
yeah.
Drag has evolved so much since you started.
Yeah.
For better or worse, what would you say are some of the bigger changes you've noticed?
Well, I think the thing is, I think the internet changed everything,
yeah.
really. Firstly, when we were doing it at like Exchange or at any of those places, you could go out any night of the week and it would be chock-a-block
with
people.
It's so true, yeah.
You know, Wednesday night would have a couple of hundred people at the Exchange, and then those people would go down to the Three Faces, and then there was little pub. When Commercial Road was really jumping, you had the Beat Bookshop, you had Hares and Hyenas, all these, you know, the whole that whole strip was magical. You know, and people went out. Now, of course, with the internet, they don't go out. Mm. It's hard enough to get people out on a Saturday night. Mm. When I was at Three Faces, and now Thursday night, it was a really big night. You get about 800 people out. It was two floors, and the show was called The Lipsticks. I'll tell you later how I got into it, because that's another story. But there was Kerry Lagore, myself, Doreen Manganini, and Zoe Knox. But people would come because, you know, that was their night out. Yeah. They absolutely loved it. You know, they thought they knew us, you know. And if they didn't come on that night, they'd be very, very disappointed for the week. Mm. In this time, you've got the AIDS crisis as well happening. Yeah. So people needed to forget about that for a minute.
Yeah.
And that's what the drag shows did. It made them forget. Yeah. Brought everybody close together.
Yeah.
And the drag has an amazing ability to do that, really.
What effect did the AIDS crisis have on the drag scene in Melbourne? A lot of the stories that I've heard are, whilst it was an awful thing that was happening, are actually quite positive stories of the community sort of banding together.
I think
that
is really true. The thing is that there were benefits. There was all these fundraisers and things like that. And the drag really got behind it. They were the positive things. And I think the thing about, you know, if people, I know when they used to come up to me at the hotel, I'd be sitting there at the bar, and you know, they, because they see you, they think they know you, you know, and they can talk to you about things. Well, you know, I couldn't get my life together, and I'm trying to help these other people, people you know, and that's just the way it was, you know, and you just do it, and we all got behind it. That's your job to do as well, you know, that's just part and parcel of what you do.
The drag queens really were sort of almost the mascots of the community, or in a way, and were doing these wonderful benefits and fundraisers and that sort of thing, and probably keeping people's spirits up.
Well, I think along the way, you know, you had groups like Also and these other groups that had these great big warehouse parties, which is now at the Docklands.
Oh, yep.
You know, there'd be literally thousands of people there having the most amazing times. And I remember doing that. I did so many of them. I was always stuck in the middle. Male dancers, it was 20 male dancers because I can't dance.
You know? Really? Candy?
I know you're not going to believe that. But the really sad thing for me about that, the end of the night, you're there with all these bags trying, you know, those awful Chinese laundry bags, those
full of drag.
Hideous.
Yeah. Every drag queen has got 100 of them.
Yeah. Oh,
it's just the worst things. And you're trying to get home. You're on your own then to try and, they love you when you're on stage, but my God, to try and get anyone to help you along the way.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. You know, it's pretty horrible.
Something I really like about drag is that it's sort of always political, and there's often an element of punk rebellion for a lot of drag artists, you know, pushing up against what's happening in society at the time. Around this time with the crisis, did you see that have any effect on the drag that people did?
You know, the thing is that the kind of drag that we did was nothing like what happens now. You know, it was drag with a sense of humour, most of it, you know. Now people will see RuPaul and and I get it, you know, they will go online and they'll buy the wig, the shoes, the dress and all that, but you can't buy talent.
Mm. Well, it does lead into addressing probably the big pink glittery elephant whenever you talk about drag is the popularity of RuPaul's Drag Race. It has changed people's perception of drag in the mainstream.
Mm.
It's also broadened its audience to, I think, a different demographic than what it was in the past. Is it something that you can get behind, or do you think it's a dilution of the art form that you've experienced?
I mean, I get it. I watched the first couple of series and then I just went off it. But I understand. I think the good thing about it is the fact that it has become, you know, across the board, straight people are watching and understanding and hearing the backstories of these people. Mm. I think the thing about it, about drag just generally, is there are always backstories that you never hear. You see the person, but you don't see what's really behind it. People think you're something that you're absolutely not.
Absolutely.
So I think the good thing about that is we are getting the world to see these people and their stories.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of cool. The people that are performing aren't going to affect me. The type of audience that I attract is a different kind of audience than they attract.
But in some ways, it can also be seen as a gateway you know, a lot of people talk about...
RuPaul is a gateway drug.
And I think RuPaul's Drag Race can be a gateway drug to queens like Candy.
You know, it's a way
for people...
I mean, I would say that your Saturday night show at DT's over the last couple of years has started attracting more and more younger people as well. Yeah,
we do.
Which are probably people that may not have seen drag until they saw something like RuPaul's.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. But without a bit of comedy in a drag show, it is absolutely...
Dry.
You know, it all looks the same. Yeah. It's like, there's got to be personality. If you've got, it's probably you going on stage looking beautiful with no personality. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, for any listeners that haven't seen you perform before, you're not a dancer, but you do these dance shows with Rita Lacolkita and Sue Ridge, and you've been doing them for decades.
Yeah.
And then what I love about you is that you don't always get the dance moves right, but you always have that cheeky little wink to the audience when you get it wrong and you have a little giggle and you're on a microphone, hilarious, which but is
I want people to be in on the gag, basically. Yeah. And I think in a drag show, you've got to have a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's very difficult to have an end when there's no big bang on the number or anything. So then you've got to get on the microphone and say something funny.
Yeah.
I think that's so much better. It shows more personality.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's the whole thing.
And your shtick is very much that you're a bloke in a dress. And that's funny. Yeah. Like, that's what you're there to see, I think.
But along the way, I've had some pretty camp experiences, I think. I did a couple of very bad movies.
Oh, no really? Way. I didn't know this.
Yeah, I did one called Done to Death.
Right.
Whoa. And it was a like a schlock horror thing.
Yeah. I love
and
that.
We used
need to hunt this down.
No, well, so I did that. And then I got, when Priscilla, Queen of the Desert came out, everybody then wanted Priscilla's at their, their New Year's Eve party or their Christmas party or their bar mitzvah or wherever.
So probably they brought it into mainstream
culture. So we were getting so much work.
Yeah, wow.
You know, we were just like, I remember a New Year's Eve, we had about like four different gigs. Mm-hmm. And one of them, we actually did the show twice and they paid us double.
Oh, bro.
It was just stupid.
A lot of your Aussie drag sisters are now doing major commercial campaigns. Art Simone and Filma Box are doing the Amy ads. Yeah. And Polly Filler did, was it domain.com, I think she did the ads for? Yes. Karen from Finance is just selling a box to any company that'll take it.
Absolutely.
But you were one of the pioneers in Australia because you did the Telstra. I remember the Telstra prepaid
cards. My God, you really are showing your age.
I am, I know.
Late 90s. It was big at the time. You know, they had those bake-off fundraisers.
Oh, like the DT's Midsummer Bake-Off sort of stuff.
And I went to one of them, and the guy who ran Telstra was there and he liked me. The next day I get a phone call and he says, will you come and do one photo for Big Pond? I didn't even know what Big Pond was.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm saying, oh yes, absolutely, not knowing what Big Pond was. Anyway, so we do this photo and it's me with a fish out of my mouth.
Oh yeah.
You know, a poster. It lasted for about 2 years or 3 years. There was about four photos and I remember them flying me up to Sydney for Mardi Gras because at that stage Telstra sponsored Mardi Gras.
Right, yeah.
They didn't have a float or anything. They weren't that brave. Mm-hmm. And I remember
would have been one of the first big organisations to do
was.
So, yeah.
And I drove around Taylor Square and I look up and here's this billboard of me.
Oh, wow.
It was kind of unbelievable because it was the thing from the postcard. It was a really beautiful shot. Yeah.
Well, you had mentioned your character loves drinking beer. Yeah. I see you've got some water on you today. You're staying hydrated.
Absolutely.
Obviously, it's a draining job and industry to be a part of. You're looking quite fit and trim and youthful sitting here. Do you have any precautions you could give to either, say, younger drag queens getting into the industry, being surrounded by booze and flashing lights and drugs?
I mean, I'm the wrong one to ask.
Yeah,
I basically did all those things in the 80s, the 90s, 2000.
That's what the
and
80s
I should
were for.
Be absolutely a basket case now. I should be drag roadkill.
Oh my gosh.
You know, but I didn't really do drugs. I mean, I drank a lot of beer and all of that, and I'm not ashamed of anything that I've done. I'm not ashamed of any of the photos that appear of me, and that was all just part and parcel. But you know, people come up to me still at the hotel, and I had someone come into the shop I work today, and they say, you know, God, they were great times. They were fantastic times and all of that. And they were great times. They were fantastic times. I don't live in the past. And I think, and I say to these people, I say, you know, these are the new memories. These are the new fabulous times that they're having
right
now.
Point,
you know, For those young drag queens, you really are asking the wrong person. Yes. I've done it.
But you have done well, though, Candy, because I think realistically, a lot of them do take drugs occasionally and do drink, but don't let that overtake their life.
Drinking beer, I wasn't the only one doing it. Everybody was doing it. You know, the 80s and the 90s, there'd be a bucket of beer in the dressing room. That's just the way it was.
Beer's just not a drink I would picture a drag queen's drink of
you
choice.
You need to come to Big Bowl and bitter on a sandwich.
Like, that's so weird.
Saturday night, Miss Candy there with a VB with a straw in it.
Oh, so true.
Well, we all did it, you know.
Yeah.
I think that was just the drink of the moment, you know.
Yeah. It's so cool to hear you talking about, I mean, I get to see Candy on stage all the time and that's fantastic and very camp and very funny, but it's so nice to hear you sort of sitting down and talking about 40 years ago, a time that was completely different to what we have now. And I'm really interested to hear about some of the relationships that you forged with the amazing queens that you've worked with throughout the years. Who are the queens that, you know, really have stuck, like memories that you've really stuck with you, the best people to work with or the most amazing performers?
Well, I've worked with some really, really fantastic people, and I've worked with some real assholes.
Yeah.
You know who you are. The people I loved was Kerry LaGore, because Kerry LaGore really changed the way the gay scene was. I mean, she worked at all of the venues, and she really got all the drag queens together and put them in big shows. The venue owners have been fantastic as well. I think they're the unsung heroes. But you also remembering that this was a time when there was a cover charge. Now you try to put a cover charge on somewhere and nobody will turn up. But the cover charge paid for the costumes, it paid for the hair, it paid for the lighting, it paid for the whole thing. You know, Barbara Quicksand, of course, Sue Ridge.
Yeah, that's a great name.
Tabitha.
Sue Ridge.
Oh, my God.
Oh, Tabitha, I love it. And I'm so glad Tabitha's come out of retirement. She's fantastic.
I mean, I gave Rita her name when she first got into drag. I said, you've got to have something really posh that sounds fantastic. It's going to look great on a marquee.
Rita La Coqueta.
Rita
La Coqueta. God, is that the full name? Oh,
Rita La Coqueta.
Well, everybody was like someone like Gay or LaGore. Yeah, you know, or like it was Kerry LaGore.
Can you just talk a little bit more about Kerry LaGore for the younger people that don't know Kerry?
Well, Kerry LaGore was great at organising things. She was responsible for putting all those shows, all those different groups, people like Paris, Rita, me, all of those girls that I mentioned, the ones that are still around, the high profile ones. Because, you know, in drag, many are called, few are chosen.
Yes.
They don't last very long.
And she did Kerry's Backyard at the Exchange. And if for anyone that's interested in looking it up, the effort that went into this show, they would film sketches that would then be shown on the TV screens there. And Pussy Willow and all those sorts of people were in these wonderful videos, little sketches that they would pre-record. That would be shown in between numbers while a costume change was happening or at the start of the show or whatever.
Yeah. Awesome.
And someone is doing a wonderful job of currently uploading all of those.
I think that's Kevin.
For who used to own the Exchange.
And he actually used to do the videos as well.
Right. And like, so there's I can't remember what the website is, but Google Exchange History, I think it's
really
called.
Like, for people who haven't sort of, perhaps the young people that are listening, it's kind of nice to go back and sort of see how it all started.
And how much effort went into it.
Because it's different. Okay, this is different, but I think the other things, older stuff, still valid as well.
Absolutely,
I think, you know, we're still valid, even though we might be 30 years older or 20 or 50 years older. You know.
So we have spent a lot of time talking about Miss Candy, but the difference between your character and Ron, you know, your day-to-day out-of-drag sort of persona as well, you know, who is Ron?
I mean, sometimes the two people do cross over. And I don't mean, you know, sometimes I can be sitting at a... Basically, I'm pretty shy. I think that, you create the character, you do things and say things that you would never say. Mm-hmm. For instance, I don't swear as a man. I hate it. I hate that kind of thing, you know. In drag.
Sailors, man.
Do you change your voice or anything like that in drag character?
No,
or?
I don't. I've always worked in clothing, in retail, and I've been lucky enough to travel through that as well. You know, I had a job where I was traveling overseas twice a year, still doing drag, but I used to go to London, Paris, Milan, and, you know, it was fantastic. So people don't know that about me. They just see this sort of trash bag racing around them. So I've always been able to have a steady job. The drag hasn't sort of taken over, although it's taken over the house. That's always the way it is, you know. I don't really have a lot of friends. I've got a lot of Facebook friends, but I've never met them. I mean, I'm still close to my family. I am, and the few friends that I've got, I sort of try to see as often as I can. I don't have a partner. I think I would like to have one, but I'm leaving my run a bit late.
I was going to ask for any listeners that might be a little bit turned on.
Well, know. I think the thing is, I think it would be very hard to actually date somebody like me. Mm-hmm. First thing, I like being alone. I'm mm-hmm. you know, I'm very much a loner as yeah. well. I've always been that. So, but I think just dating a drag queen would be a pretty horrible experience.
Well, this show reaches a couple thousand people, I think, every week. Okay. So you're putting
an ad. We'll pop some pictures. We'll put an ad on.
We'll make your Tinder profile.
We'll just add the sound effect now.
Miss Candy, can I say it has been such an honour to have you here to talk to us today.
I've enjoyed it.
Drag royalty in Australia, and it's so nice to have a conversation with you outside of the smoking area. Definitely. DTs.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining
My
us.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you. I could listen to you all day, honestly. Like, so mesmerizing.
Of course, you can catch Miss Candy at Big Bold and Bitter on Saturday nights at DT's Hotel. Free entry. What time's the first show, Candy?
The first show's 10 o'clock drag time, which is 10:30. And two shows. We've got great costumes. And there's a really good mixed crowd there as
it's
well.
It's a lovely
so you
crowd.
Can come and have a really nice time.
We'll see great. You there.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
So we've got another guest for this episode, and I'm really happy to welcome Nick Hollis joining us in the studio to talk about some serious issues.
Thank you so much
so
for
having me. So
thrilled
to have you. We've quoted you so many times and read so many things that you've written on this podcast, so it's nice to finally have you here.
Oh, I know that.
Which I'm sure you know because you've listened to every episode.
Religiously, yeah. Absolutely. Thank you.
So just to start off, Nick, you're the founder of the Institute of Many, or TIM. Now, that's a place where people who are living with HIV, to give a bit more info, can find support online, in person. For the listeners who may not be that familiar with your work, could you let us know a little bit more about TIM?
Sure, absolutely. Well, TIM is a lot of things to a lot of different people, which is why I love it. Like, it's a grassroots movement for people living with HIV. We're the largest of our kind in Australia. We have members from around Australia and overseas as well. For some people, it is just a private Facebook group that they use to find peer support, ask questions, get feedback, share news and information about living with HIV. And for others, it's a movement that they've been a part of anywhere between, you know, a day to several years. And we do activism. We do campaigns, we do resources for people, and, you know, we march in Mardi Gras every year, and it's turned into, well, it's turned into the most important thing I've done with my life, but it's also become this invaluable platform for us to bring HIV into the 21st century.
Yeah.
As a person that's not living with HIV but reading a lot about it, I guess I can't really speak from the perspective of someone that's used TIM. But what I like when I read about it is I feel like there's a lot of support groups, and not just in the HIV universe, but for lots of different community subcultures, I guess, that are either split down to sort of the medical side of it or the social side of it. And what I really like about TIM is that there's both of those options, or both of those things if you want to have one or the other or both.
Well, that's like so important, because obviously what unites all people living with HIV is that we live with HIV, and that is a chronic medical condition.
Yeah.
You know, some of us vote one way, some of us vote another, but what unites us all is this condition. So we need a space as peers where we can talk about, you know, changing treatments or side effects, but also the broader social issues around HIV.
Yeah.
One of the things we talked about with Dr. George last week was how people find the right doctor for them. Is that something that you sort of find people are doing with the group, giving advice for people that have recently been diagnosed with HIV about which doctors they've been to or which ones they think would be helpful with?
Absolutely. And look, and that's, we're really fortunate living here in the bubble of inner city Melbourne that we have so many fantastic HIV specialist GPs. We've got one, you know, I've got expert clinics on both sides of the river even. And, you know, up in Sydney, it's the same.
Very rare that something happens on both sides of the river in Melbourne.
Other than Tom.
Yeah.
But these days, obviously living with HIV goes outside of that bubble. Mm. So whilst it's super important that our members can talk about which clinic is best for them and what kind of doctor might suit their needs, you know, you step outside of that, you go to outer suburban Melbourne where it's a total schlep to get into Northside Clinic, for example, and let alone people who live in rural and regional Australia who have maybe one S100 doctor, that's the doctor who can prescribe your HIV meds, or they've got to go two towns over or something like that. So it's really complex finding that level of care and support, because I know for a fact, I mean, I was almost diagnosed with HIV out in regional Australia, and the GP I met knew nothing about HIV, let alone gay sex or anything like that. So, yeah, it can be really awkward.
Mm.
And with the introduction of PrEP as a preventative strategy for contracting HIV, which has been an absolute game changer in our community, as someone living with HIV, what is your view on PrEP?
Well, firstly, I think we are so fortunate to be living in an era that we have PrEP.
Absolutely.
When I mean... If during the very height of the AIDS crisis in the 80s and early 90s, if you turned to the gay community and said, oh, by the way, we've got this pill you can take that's going to prevent you acquiring HIV, there would be absolutely no conversation. We would be rushing to get it.
That's it.
But of course, things have changed so much since that time. I think that we are really fortunate to be in the year of PrEP, because now we have so many tools in the toolbox. Mm. You know, we have PrEP, we've got U equals U, and we've got condoms, and they all work really well. And the exciting thing is they don't have to work in isolation. Mm. You know, you can be on PrEP and still use condoms. I also think that it is a testament to the extraordinary success of people affected by HIV and people living with HIV fighting for safe sex, fighting for condoms.
Yeah.
We were so good at that, that it's taken hold in such a way that for some people, letting go of the idea that condoms are the best form of protection and thus the only form is really difficult for those people. And the most important thing is it's like, just don't yuck anyone's yum. That's my big thing around that condom versus everything else. It doesn't have to be so adversarial.
Sorry, just you mentioned U equals U, which is probably a term that not everybody is familiar with yet, unfortunately. Can you expand a little bit more?
Of course. So when I talk about U equals U, what I mean there is undetectable equals untransmittable, which means that when a person living with HIV can access effective treatment, it means that there is zero risk of them passing HIV on to their partners. That is
a very important thing for people
And it's a bigger... I can swear on this podcast, right?
Yes, absolutely.
It's a bigger mindfuck than PrEP and condoms even. Yeah. The notion that people living with HIV are not infectious is a massive psychological thing for us to get our heads around, whether you're living with HIV or not.
Mm.
So we have these three things now. They all work really well. And it upsets me to see us pitting them against one another.
Absolutely.
And it's, you know, I'm sure we'll get to this in a second, but the events of the last week or so have really highlighted for me that there is a cohort of gay men who are on PrEP. They are using it to protect themselves from acquiring HIV, which is great. That's what it's for. But PrEP is also amazing because it has the ability to free us from our serophobia, our irrational fear of people living with HIV and HIV itself. It makes me sad to see that there is this cohort of gay men on PrEP who aren't using PrEP to untangle themselves from their HIV stigma. And for me, that's just not giving yourself the full experience. Mm. Like, it's like watching Drag Race without watching Untucked. Like, you've got to give yourself the full story. Yeah. And it's so great that we have that ability to do that. I recognize HIV is such a massive thing. It hangs over us as a community. So you understand where people arrive at this serophobia and how difficult it is. But PrEP is that entry point for people.
I always find it really interesting. I mean, we just had Miss Candy on the podcast as well and talking about, like, you know, working in the scene during the AIDS epidemic and stuff. I find it really interesting that the people that lived through that seem to have less of a fear of HIV than the people that have been born since. And it breaks my heart that a lot of younger people, and it seems to get exponentially worse with the younger people are and the further away we are from the AIDS epidemic, that stigma seems to be growing. Do you see that?
I see it in so many ways, and it takes different forms, and I can see the opposite happen as well. There are people who went through the AIDS crisis. None of us here can actually talk about it or really understand it fully, the degree of trauma that those elders experienced. And I see some of them doubling down on their serophobia. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, they are some of the quickest to talk about PrEP, you've got to use condoms, because mm-hmm. they were there fighting for our rights to be able to access condoms.
Yeah,
so true. You understand where that went through. And then as well, you do see younger people who are so far away from the AIDS crisis. And I mean, like literally, there are 19-year-olds on the scene right now who were born in this millennium.
Yeah.
I should freak us all out. It's terrifying. God bless them. And good luck to them. But they're not even millennially attracted to the AIDS crisis in the way that the rest of us were. Mm. And that's also really important for us to consider. Why should these younger people need to feel dragged down and weighed down by the AIDS crisis in the way that certain older generations are? So I get that. We want them to feel
liberated,
from all of that. Otherwise, why are we just dragging them down with previous traumas? Mm-hmm. Conversely, this wasn't something that was 100 years ago.
No,
people are still alive that are feeling the impact of that crisis, whether you lived through the AIDS crisis or you grew up underneath it. So multiple considerations there. I think what we are seeing amongst some younger gay men is that they are reaching this kind of era of sexual experimentation and sex positivity a lot earlier than their older gay friends from even like 5 or 6 years ago. Mm. So you could arrive at that late 20s, early 30s, dirty 30 kind of stage. Mm. And that's where we were seeing the bread and butter of new HIV infections. It wasn't 21-year-olds who were acquiring HIV at a rapid rate. It was this 30 to 40 something.
Yeah, okay.
And that was a lot too with condom fatigue too. Yeah. 10 years plus of safe sex messaging. Then you're like, oh, maybe I can start taking risks.
Yeah.
PrEP has helped these younger queer men arrive at this point of sex positive sex exploration earlier. And it's so exciting to see. Like, this is, it feels like it's, we're kind of going back to gay lib era in the 70s. Mm. And we can reimagine that chunk of time that we lost in our acceleration.
Generationally, I also remember being a child of the 90s. HIV was a big boogeyman for the gay community, and being young at that time, that was sort of the go-to way to suppress our community, to scare our community.
It still is for a lot of people, but yeah.
I think that mentality was really hard for me to get out of as well, and PrEP was a big thing in that it seemed like some science fiction-y kind of thing, because suddenly this boogeyman that the mainstream media had sort of been trying to frighten you with for years was suddenly, you know, not something that was going to pop out and surprise you and bowl you down in a bowling alley.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think there were a lot of gay men from that generation that grew up with that. It's about untangling, and that can be a really tricky thing.
Do you think that was an essential? I mean, obviously now there's a lot of work being done to undo this mind frame that people had from the time. Is it your opinion that that was an essential thing for them to do at the time because there was no other way of, they didn't really know what they were dealing with and that was the only way of doing it?
It was such a complex time. I think, I mean, if you go back and look at the campaign, which is the Grim Reaper campaign.
Yeah, but there was a whole lot of others that were similar vibes.
Lots of other public awareness campaigns. They were successful when the people affected by HIV were central in creating the messaging. When things got a bit broader or out of our control, it got harder. So then we ended up with the Grim Reaper.
Yeah, right.
Which a lot of people don't know. One of the people that came up with the Grim Reaper campaign was Ida Buttrose.
Oh, really?
Gay icon.
I thought you were going to say the Grim Reaper was gay.
There was a disastrous Glam Reaper campaign that tried to reinvigorate the notion a few years ago. Check it out. It's
was
online
it in Australia?
Somewhere. Oh, God, yeah, absolutely. Of course
it was. We bungle it so badly sometimes.
Yes and no. Like, it was such a hard time because in the early days, people were just throwing something on the wall and hoping it would stick. Yeah. And but these days we're having to work, I think, extra hard because it felt like for a long time we didn't talk about this enough. There wasn't anything to report. Like in 1996, which, you know, some of you might even be younger than that.
No, definitely not.
Okay. That's a compliment. Take that as a compliment.
I wasn't looking at you when I said that.
Kyle's not here for this interview, so.
But in 1996, the treatments for HIV changed forever. We had that magical turning point. It wasn't magical. It was a scientific turning point for HIV treatments. We are now further from 1996 than we are from 1982-ish, the start of the virus.
Wow, yeah, that's a good point.
And yet here we still are having to convince people that U equals U works, convince people that HIV does not equal AIDS. And it speaks to, I think, the incredible pernicious impact that AIDS has had on our collective consciousness as human beings. And you think that that's everyone. That's going out to suburban whatever and country town whatever and talking about HIV, they'll think about AIDS. What it must feel like for all of us to know that HIV is associated with us as people, as a community. This will take generations to untangle. But yeah, it's I'm glad the work's happening.
Yeah. So for those listeners that are unaware of the events that have happened in the last few weeks, as we've talked about before, there's only ever been a handful of recorded cases globally where PrEP users have gone on to contract HIV. And the most recent case was the subject of an interview which you conducted in the wonderful Star Observer last week with Steve Spencer, who is probably the second most quoted person on this podcast. Steve's the guy that, for anyone that's been to Gay Times Festival, we traditionally pull the first ball of Granny Bingo out of Steve.
Oh, really?
wonderful person. So Steve was on PrEP and contracted HIV in December and then came out wonderfully by hosting the Tim Float at Mardi Gras and did that wonderful Facebook post as well. What kind of stuff did Steve want to talk about and sort of make clear to people about his case in the interview?
Yeah, it was, I mean, firstly, whenever we talk about this, I think it's really important to put in context that we're talking about someone who's recently been diagnosed with HIV. Yeah. That experience has changed so much over the years, but what doesn't change is the shock that you realize that your life has changed forever. Mm-hmm. How fortunate we are that it means your life has changed forever, not that you're going to die.
Yes.
So that's a really great thing. Steve and I talked a lot about this over the last couple of months, knowing that this was going to happen, knowing that he wanted to come out publicly, which I obviously supported, knowing that it would attract a lot of questions, fair share of criticism, possibly even a fair bit of projected anxiety towards him for doing this. But this is the second case of a person seroconverting whilst on PrEP in Australia. Different circumstances to the Melbourne incident that happened a couple of years ago, but different also because that person, they have never really been able to come out about that experience. Right. Mm-hmm. But when the word got out that this had happened 2 years ago in Melbourne, I'm sure you all remember it was all over Facebook in the Melbourne community and went national. And that person was unable to even defend themselves, speak up. And here they were, a newly diagnosed person living with HIV, trying to wrestle with the fact that they were at this center and everyone was discussing their lifestyle choices with having no concept of even who they are. And then you've got Steve, who is the opposite of that. I couldn't think. It's not many people who, you know, would consent to having the first bingo ball pulled out of them out of Granny Bingo. But Steve is absolutely that person.
Yeah.
And we have been comrades in kind of highly visible HIV discussion for years. And I think he knew that he couldn't just come out to his friends and potential lovers on Scruff and Grindr and whatever, and because he was that poster boy and he needed to be able to declare it so that he could live authentically.
Yeah.
The other part of it, and this is super important, is that he wanted to be able to come out and talk about the facts of why PrEP works.
Yeah.
That he wasn't questioning it. He believes in PrEP. He continues to believe in PrEP. He knows it works. And the other thing too, I'm pretty sure he wanted to celebrate the fact that as a person living with HIV, he arrived at having an undetectable viral load within the classic six-week period and was feeling really good about that too. So ultimately, it was a good news story.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think for me, reading that, both Steve's original post and then your interview, I don't want to blow smoke up Steve's ass, although I'm sure that would be very easy to do. But
I think I've seen that video.
I just got this overwhelming sense of how selfless it was to having been diagnosed only in December and then still wanting to share all this information with people and give them the full set of facts with how successful PrEP is, even though it's what some people call a PrEP failure. Yeah, I was really blown away at that. And you conducted such a wonderful interview with him as well. So well done to you and well done to Steve on that.
Thank you. Oh, look, it's really all of Steve. I think that there is a transactional cost to living so openly.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel a bit of empathy for Steve, although the situation in which I came out publicly as a person living with HIV a few years ago is so different to what it is now. Mm-hmm. We didn't have PrEP even. It's only been 6 years since I came out as POS in Hello Mister and stuff. But so I was also interested to see at where community sentiment is at with Steve's announcement too. Mm.
After interviewing Steve, how do you feel like the reaction has been to the interview and like what feedback have you gotten?
I want to say overwhelmingly, it's been really supportive. I nearly said it's been really positive. Fight a dollar for every time I made that pun. It's been really supportive. The number of people commenting at Steve's bravery and how this is really important to remind people that, you know, PrEP is 99% effective. Mm-hmm. It's triggered a really fantastic conversation in the community, I think, amongst people. I have also been confronted, I think, with the number of gay men at risk of HIV and some living with HIV who have shown their fear and anxiety and xerophobia through this. And that's what's prompted me to reflect on just how many gay men on PrEP aren't using PrEP to untangle themselves from their xerophobia. People do panic. Some people have tried to claim that, you know, this is irresponsible of us to be sharing this story, but it happened.
Mm.
It's a thing that actually exists. Like, people need to know that PrEP is 99% effective. There are going to be these people. And it's also prompted some really interesting discussions about PrEP on demand, which not a lot of people knew about.
Speaking of PrEP on demand, where a person takes PrEP before and after sex, as opposed to taking it every day, do we know if that's as effective as taking a daily pill?
What we know from the studies about on demand is that the level of protection it affords you from HIV is just as effective as daily PrEP, but it is in earlier stages than what we know about daily PrEP. So that's one consideration. The majority of people on the IPA-Gay, I love that it was called the IPA-Gay study, in France, where on-demand PrEP was kind of initially trialed, were having enough sex to necessitate on-demand PrEP in a way that meant they were kind of taking about, you know, 4 pills or so per week kind of vibe.
Oh, I see. Yeah, right.
So this is a little bit different to, say, the person who has been on nothing for 6 months, mm-hmm. has sex once and takes 2 pills 2 hours prior to the sex and then one every day after until after the sex ends. Does that make sense? So that is where things are maybe a little bit questionable around this. And we should also point out, you know, the Kirby is investigating this on-demand incident. The great thing is we know PrEP works. We know daily PrEP works. We still have PrEP failures. I hate the word failure. I should probably think of another word. But we have PrEP failures.
Anomalies.
Yeah, thank you. Snafus. Hiccups. We have these when people are on daily PrEP too. So it's also important to remember that neither of these things are a silver bullet, and that whilst the level of protection, and for the 500,000 people on PrEP around the world, to have 3 confirmed cases of daily PrEP failure and 7 in total around the world that are being investigated, the numbers are so
low. In my mind, prior to PrEP being introduced, the only precaution method we had was condoms, which means technically you have to say that every HIV diagnosis prior to PrEP was a HIV failure if you think that this is a failure. Yeah. So if we've had 7 cases out of, how many did you say people?
I think 500,000.
500,000 people. That's a pretty good statistic.
Yeah.
So we've talked a lot about U equals U, and obviously HIV is no longer the death sentence that it once was. Medically speaking, what does it mean now to be living with HIV? For someone that's never met anyone that's living with HIV, what do you have to do to stay U equals U and to stay healthy? Like how much does it physically affect you? If that's not too personal a question.
Of course, no, not at all. Well, I'll start with myself because I'm kind of the most privileged example you can get of a person living with HIV, in that I live in inner city Melbourne. Mm-hmm. I'm an Australian citizen and I am, you know, devastatingly attractive. So I get to go to a very nearby HIV specialist who gives me my prescription for my meds every 6 months. And then I toddle off to a nearby dispensing pharmacist. I could go to any pharmacist in Australia to collect it, which I don't pay for, and I pick it up. So I'm in such a privileged position. I take 1 pill a day. It gives me 0 side effects. It's always been that way. And that 1 pill a day maintains my undetectable viral load, which means that I have 0 risk of passing on to my partner. And more importantly, although sometimes it doesn't feel that way, more importantly, it stops HIV in its tracks in my body to prevent me from going on to defining an AIDS defining illness. Yeah. If I stopped taking those medications today, in anywhere between 5 to 10 years, I would be a person with AIDS defining illnesses and I would eventually die. That's not stopping anytime soon. So that's me in my extraordinary privileged kind of background. As a person living with HIV, I'm still discriminated against in some legal contexts. I can still be accused of lying about my HIV status by a partner, and that could result in me being charged, even if I didn't pass HIV on to them, even if I have an undetectable viral load, although that's possibly changing, but a complaint could still be raised against me.
Is that a federal law?
It depends state by state where you're at, but in every state in Australia, you can find yourself implicated legally as a person living with HIV. Yeah. We've got people in prisons at the moment in Australia around stuff like that. So that risk is always there. And then, of course, there's just the ongoing stigma and discrimination that still pops up for all the reasons we're talking about. You know, in me, that manifests mainly on the apps. I'm a pretty open person about my HIV status. I'm also not super burnt by it, but that's me. There are certainly people who feel differently.
Yeah.
Then, of course, once we broaden out beyond that circle of privilege, things get a lot harder and a lot more complex. Heterosexual people living with HIV in Australia are more likely to be late diagnosed, which means they could have AIDS-defining illnesses. First Nations people living in rural and remote communities in particular are falling through a horrific gap in healthcare. And for your listeners, as you might not realise, but overseas-born gay and bisexual men, their HIV rates are going up while the general HIV rates are going down. And that's got a lot to do with appropriate and effective safe sex messaging and healthcare messaging going to them. So, you know, international students in Melbourne, for example, are coming to Australia, finding a gay culture that maybe doesn't exist in a similar way in their country of origin, but they're not being given the care and support that we all take for granted, because we all spot the Thorn Harbour Health ads on the side of a bus. We know what it is. We connect with it. We get the message. We might not do it every time, what they're asking in terms of condoms or taking PrEP or whatever, but we see the message and we know it's for us. I would love, for my legacy alone, I would love to be the last HIV positive poster boy who looks and sounds like me, because the epidemic doesn't look like me anymore. New HIV infections in a few years won't look like people that look like me.
Yeah,
I think our trans brothers and sisters and non-conforming siblings experience HIV in a completely different way. Yeah. They get shut out of it in many ways. We're seeing small spikes in HIV transmission in lesbian communities as the queer community kind of finds itself in a new heightened era of sex-positive poly activity. Queer women are jumping into bed with other queer people, and that's a community that typically has been almost exclusively kept safe from the HIV epidemic. And then, of course, there's all sorts of stuff when it comes to trans people. You know, the way that HIV can be transmitted to someone with a vagina or a front hole is different. The tissue within a vagina has a different absorption ability compared to the anal mucosa. I'm getting very technical here, everyone. But it actually impacts how quickly PrEP works, even, for example. And that sort of stuff isn't being studied widely enough. Okay. So we need trans people in more studies. Mm-hmm. We need them to be more active in the space. Mm-hmm. That's not from a want of trying on their part. It's up to researchers to get more involved and for campaigning messages to be way better. I think Australia has been fortunate in that our HIV response has been largely contained to gay and bisexual men in this country, even in other similar environments like the US or Canada. Mm-hmm. It's been much broader, but it's been really contained to gay men. And that's because sex workers worked really hard to prevent it spreading through their community here, and injecting drug users lobbied really hard for safer injecting equipment. Yeah. But what that means is we've had 30 years of talking to only gay and bi men, and now we need to talk to more people. So we've got to change the message and who's got the microphone.
Nick, I just want to say a big, big thank you for coming in and chatting with us today and giving us your expertise.
We have to have you back again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, please.
It's been fascinating. It's been really good. Such a good chat.
I'm offended that it's taken this long. No, thank you so much for the opportunity to come in. It really means a lot. We're doing all we can to bring the entire community with us, and conversations like this is where a lot of it starts. So thanks for having me.
You're doing a great job. Thank you, darling.
Thank you. Loves.
Well, that was a great episode, having two interviews in this week, having Miss Candy on the show and Nick Hollis. Incredible. I want to say a big, big thank you once again for coming on the show.
Two wonderful icons of our
community.
Yeah. I feel like they could just replace me.
Yeah. I feel like let's hand the show over to the two of them. They can just run the whole show.
We're out of a gig, guys. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Gays Revolting Pod, or join our group, The Gays Are Revolting, on Facebook, where we'll share embarrassing clips of Miss Candy and whatever we can find of Nicholas.
Yeah.
Please rate and review us on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcast. We'd much appreciate it.
Yeah, leave us a good one, please. Yeah. Everyone, do it now. Five stars.
We like good.
Yeah. Don't think about it. Just review it.
Oh, I love you all so much. Okay. Oh, I hate that it's going to be a whole other week until I see.
A whole week.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello? Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.